It's time for Mac Break Weekly. I'm Jason Snell, sitting in for Leo Laporte, who is bobbing somewhere in a river in Europe, probably. I have Alex Lindsay, Andy Anatko, as always, and special guest star, author, raconteur, tech reporter, Dan Morin. We got lots to talk about. Apple's developer conference, future of watchOS, so much more coming at you now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
MacBreak Weekly, episode 864 for April the 4th, 2023. The War on Buttons.
This episode of MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. With employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? The Meraki Cloud Managed Network, that's how. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by ACI Learning. ACI Learning amplifies expertise across industries that command higher pay. ACI Learning, transforming how companies train and technology professionals learn to fuel the modern workforce. For premium training in audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, visit go.acilearning.com/twit. Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks for your support.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly. I am Jason Snell, sitting in for Leo Laporte. Normally, I'm in one of these boxes next to me, and Leo is in this chair. But Leo is traveling the world. He's doing wonderful things. He's making memories that will last a lifetime. He's leaving only footprints behind. But we're here to talk about Apple with two of our usual panelists and a fill-in for me, because I'm, again, sitting in this chair today. Of course, as always, my good pal for murmur years in the tech industry, Andy Anatko, is here. Hi, Andy.
Hello. Look out your window. Are there pyres of burning things on the horizon? Does it look like the things have turned for the better or for the worse? I have a feeling that things are going to change this afternoon during our very podcast recording. Not that that puts any more obligations or responsibilities on your shoulders. I'm sure you can handle it, Jason.
Well, it's a funny story. On the way here, on the drive here, I happened to go past a groundhog who was looking at his shadow. I don't know what that means, but
Some time out for himself. You know, usually it's like people are asking of him, when does the groundhog get to sniff and then eat the roses?
I feel really bad for the groundhog's child, because the groundhog's child spends their whole childhood living in the shadow of their parent.
Nepo babies.
Yeah. Also here is Alex Lindsay from many things, Office Hours .global included, 090.media. Hi, Alex.
Hey, good to be here.
You beamed in from wherever you were before the show.
I like to, transport in and out.
No, I don't like it when you're 50% opacity. It's very disturbing. It's like you're a jellyfish. It scares me.
See, I'm kind of here.
It's a ghost of Alex Lindsay joins us.
Yes, exactly.
He's making his transparency statement. They say that ethics and tech journalism is dead.
What if you did a whole quarterly 50% transparent? I don't think people would. You'd say we're being transparent. We're really trying to tell you everything there is to go.
We don't even line up. We can't even.
Oh, right.
All right. And also, the show can't go off the rails if it never starts on the rails. Filling in for me as a panelist this week, it is my co-conspirator from sixcolors.com. He's slowly fading into the video right now. It's Dan Morin. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason. It's nice to be here on this auspicious day where the big news is that Finland is joining NATO, and I'm just going to take a sip of water right now, and oh my God.
Let's talk about WWDC, shall we? I know the wrong people, but Apple's developer conference, everybody, all the people are like, when's it going to be? When's it going to be? When's it going to be? And maybe it's because, they're in far off places and they want to be in California and that you have to make plane reservations, but surely we all knew that June 5th was going to be the date, right? Surely we all knew that. already.
When has it ever been any other day? Like it's the first Monday of every June. Like, and you think there's like this mystery, but I don't remember any time when it wasn't the first Monday, even when it was like the first.
Yeah.
When you have to buy non-refundable plane tickets. You just don't, you're like, I'm 90% sure, but am I $600 90% sure?
Right.
But it's also really different now because like 5 years ago, WWDC meant you're going to be going to like a Shriners convention with 2000 other Mac and iOS developer nerds. And so, yeah, you kind of had to be there. And also Apple had a lot more at stake because you have to prepare for the arrival of 2000 nerds and make sure that they're all scheduled, make sure that they're all accommodated for. And now that Apple really does, as Alex had been predicting for the, or maybe hoping for the past couple of years, Apple really does seem to be committed now to, no, we really don't want to have 2,000 nerds in our house tracking through our hallways. We're just going to do all virtual stuff. And now they're probably going to have a very, very limited live keynote, which they can easily reschedule for, they can easily backfill for whenever they want. Now it's almost as if they can really announce it 2 months in advance. And whatever they're ready for on June 5th, they'll be ready for. Whatever they're not ready for, it's not as though they had to make this huge investment of scheduling and planning in order to move things in and out of the schedule. So, yeah, I think that we may as well just make it like a holy day of obligation where just like you just know what day it is on the calendar. You can basically book it in advance if, again, assuming that you're there to basically try to lean on people who might be loose-lipped because they're excited that something finally shipped. But yeah,
I think that it is the trend. I mean, NVIDIA had their conference a couple weeks ago, and it was the last time they did it physically, it was 8,000 people. and the last one they did that was completely digital was 250,000.
Yeah.
And so the scale is much different as you start to go virtual. Apple, you know, E3 got canceled, which is typically a week after. The trend is not towards bigger physical events. Like that's not where we're going. And, you know, a lot of people want to think about that, but I think that this makes a lot more sense. One thing that I think has been a huge service to all Apple users is the fact that we're recording all those sessions now ahead of time and not forcing developers to stand on stage in front of 300 people and try to recite something that they memorized anyway. You know, and so the thing is they memorized it, they rehearsed it, and then they have to perform it. And it's just not fair to them. It's not fair to us because we have to watch it. And so, I think that the fact that we are now, those are all pre-recorded, so much nicer. Yeah. I just wish they'd record them, they'd release them all on Monday. There's this weird thing that Apple has done in the last couple of years, which is that we're going to release some on Monday and then on some on Tuesday and some on Wednesday. And I'm like, just how about all of them on Monday? And then we pick the ones we want to watch, you know, and that we'll see what happens with that. I'm hoping that they'll give that part up.
It's a little more manageable throughout the week, though. I mean, I also like going in with like 200 sessions being like, I got to find the things I want to look for. So I kind of like that they're trying to build a community aspect around like a shared, okay, this is what's happening on Monday, but Tuesday, Wednesday, et cetera. But it is a little strange to have it like when it is in theory. Yeah, they could just hit that button and they could all be there.
Yeah. And the other point is that I don't think that it was appreciated exactly how disruptive it was to Apple to have so many of their engineers and so many of their key people tied up, or at least they're having their schedules really, really messed up for an entire week. And now that basically you can, even if the person who is in charge of explaining everything that there is about RealityKit for a new unannounced wearable, you can pre-tape all of that. And then at a time that's absolutely at the convenience of their schedule, and it won't disrupt anything anywhere.
So, yeah, the way they're handling it is interesting. So, yes, the video production is going on in advance. That will disrupt them to a certain degree, but I think that there's more of a security blanket, right? There's less of the, what if I say something wrong? If you're doing it and you just say something wrong, you just re-record the video and there are professionals there to do all of that. There is a little bit of work for some people at Apple that week. They are doing, again, presumably what they did last year, where they have basically little Slack instances where you can go and chat with people who are Apple engineers. So they have to be sort of available for that, some of them. But that's one of the nice things they've done now of making an online event, because the point that I think we all need to recognize is that WWDC has been an online event for 99 point something percent of Apple developers for years and years because the event got so big so quickly that it sold out and people who wanted to come couldn't come. So right. their experience was the videos anyway, right? And so embracing that and saying, no, that is the experience, is the videos. And then separately, there's this Monday event, which I think we're all assuming will be very similar to what we saw last year, where some developers are going to win a lottery and they're going to get to come to Apple Campus and sit somewhere, maybe Cafe Max, maybe the Steve Jobs Theater, and that the press will probably similarly be invited. And they have like a 1 day kind of dog and pony show where you can watch the keynote and you can go visit the developer center. And it's a fun in-person event. But if you're not there, it's OK. You're getting the same presentations as everyone else. It's just streaming like it was. And that's OK.
I do wonder about the keynote, you know, so as we move to this whole pre-recorded thing, and obviously the virtues are huge, right? You can run whatever demos you want. It's all pre-recorded. There's no chance that anything goes wrong because, as you said, you can just fix it. But I do wonder if the pendulum will swing back at some point because of surely the spectacle nature of it. Like, you don't want to go to the circus and watch a pre-recorded like acrobats flying around. There's no interest in that. Like everybody, and it helps prove something to a certain degree, right? Like when it's like watching game footage, you know, when they show off the new games and everyone's like, well, but is that a pre-rendered cutscene or is that actual gameplay, right? Like what they're showing us on screen is obviously exactly what they want us to see. And of course our questions are going to be, but what happens with all that stuff that like when you push the envelope, when you do the things that are sort of in those weird corners, and not just to break it, but to like experience like what are like the limits of this thing. So I do think you lose a little bit of something by having it pre-recorded in that you miss that chance for a little bit of danger and a little bit of excitement, but I'm sure Apple doesn't quite see it that way.
Yeah, I think the problem is they're not really acrobats. They're, when we talk about the circus, the problem is they're not very good at this. Like, you know, most people who go on stage, we have to remember that most people do corporate presentations. They don't do these all day. They're not actors. They're not performers. They're really not very interesting to watch on stage. And so the hard part is that the pre-record, you know, gives them their best option to look as good as they possibly can. And I don't think they're going back. You're seeing more and more of these conferences. And what happened was Apple, I think, instigated this in the sense that we started seeing Apple do this. We started seeing NVIDIA and other people doing this. And then people said, well, why? How has Google lost so much energy? And why does Microsoft's event feel so boring? It's because they were still doing them live. So the thing is, we're used to watching this much more produced, higher velocity, much more visually interesting video. And then when we go back to the stage, it just feels like it fell off a cliff, you know, and it's just from an energy perspective. I don't think they can go back. And I don't think we're going to see any of that. I do think that being able to bring press in and having them be able to play with it, to do all the things you're talking about, which is to push the envelope and bang on it and do things with your, you know, and see what it'll do. I think that's super important. Bringing the press in to see the equipment there is important. But the actual stage, staged piece, and the reality is I've worked on keynotes, many keynotes for many companies for a decade. You know, nothing about that's real anyway. It's like when we were like, there's so much, like I don't know what Apple does, but we have backups to the, you know, to the presentation. The presentation even looks like it's going to hiccup. You'll see this little glitch in the pixels, and now we're just playing it out for you so that we don't have to show you a blue screen. So it's not a you know, it's not that real as it is. It's just a lot faster. And what we don't have to do is watch people who are not professional speakers try to speak, which is, you know, that's the only time they do it every year. And it's really hard to watch.
Bonus is nobody gets hit by a thrown Steve Jobs camera. So
that's it is. I mean, we lose. That's the acrobat falling off of the whatever they're on,
right?
The tightrope.
Turn off your Wi-Fi, everybody.
Is that moment. And it's very entertaining, but obviously something that Apple would never want you to do. Yeah. I think just to remind everybody, if you don't remember, last June, Apple held this event and press and developers were at the Cafe Max in the ring at Apple Park, and they had a big screen at like a Jumbotron set up, and they played the video on there simultaneous with streaming it to everybody else. So it was a live event, but live really only in the sense that a bunch of people were there, but they were watching the same video. Last September, Apple introduced the iPhone at an event at the Steve Jobs Theater. It was otherwise very much like WWDC in that there was an audience in the Steve Jobs Theater, but all we did, because I was there for that one, is watch the screen and watch the same video that was being streamed out to everyone else. The difference being that the press then went outside the theater to where all those new products were set up in a hands-on demo area. So the question I have for WWDC for 23 is it like last June? Is it a little more like last September? Is it a hybrid? Do they put the developers at Cafe Max in the ring and have the press go to the Steve Jobs Theater and have two totally separate events that are happening simultaneously? I don't know. For WWDC, they led us over to the Steve Jobs Theater for our briefings and hands-on after the event. They took us away. They swept us away from the from where the developers were, so that the press could not, you know, we could tempt them. We could turn them to our evil ways, and they don't want that. They want to keep the developers nice and pure. So I guess that's a stagecraft question: is if they might do that.
Well, Andy? It really is. It's less about stagecraft. I think it's about more about control. Apple has always been a company that loves to maintain control mm-hmm. over every situation. But I really think they've kicked it up in the post Jobs era in the past 5 or 6 or 7 years, where, I mean, most of the people in this conversation, actually, I think all of the people in this conversation have been at Apple events for more than 10 years. And we remember one of the reasons that justified for me spending more than $1,000 to fly from the East Coast to the West Coast for a presentation where, technically speaking, I suppose all I'm getting, you think that all I'm getting is a small amount of hands-on in a demo area if I don't have a meeting with the executives or whatever. But a lot of it was, hey, I recognize that person. That person is one of the head engineers on a project I'm very much interested in. I think I'll have an informal chat with him and see if his tongue is a little bit loose, or just overhearing conversations between people. And now Apple will never want to have that happen. And so this is the situation where they're going to make sure that if press are invited, when press are invited, they are in their own corral, and they are going to be steered through hallways where they cannot interact with anybody else to the place where they're supposed to be, because God forbid you have a conversation that is not being observed, controlled, corrected, or tamped down by Apple marketing. That's one of the signs of the newer version of Apple.
So I agree about the control. Control. Never forget about Apple wanting control. And when Alex talks about completely rightly that you've got people who are not experts as speaking, but they get them to do the videos, and but they're not in front of a packed house. That's true. But the other part of it is just control. It's always there. Apple wants complete control of the message. And if you pre-tape everything, then it goes through a whole approval process, and nothing, not a pixel is not intended exactly where it is intended to be. So it's a key part of it. I will say, though, that, you know, I talked to some random Apple people at the iPhone event last September outside the Steve Jobs Theater. There are still people around you can talk to who are from Apple, but you're right. It's not quite the same as literally everybody who works at Apple is at a convention center somewhere off campus.
Oh, yeah.
It's a different kind of vibe completely.
And what I will say is, I mean, sure, there's a chance that something could go wrong. But if we look at the last live events that happened before the going to pre-tape, I mean, every word is memorized. and they're reading off a I wish it was memorized, because they're reading them off a teleprompter. They, you know, where they're putting their hands, how they're standing, you can tell that and that's what makes it so uncomfortable to watch, is that somebody told them not to do the thing with their hands that they do every time they talk, and you keep on rocking back and forth. Don't do that anymore. And don't, you know, like you have this thing that you say right before you say the thing, stop doing that.
Yeah.
And so, and
they end up as robots, right?
And Apple does that more than anyone else, and they tighten them. The only company that really got good at this, in my opinion, is Salesforce. You know, their public facing speakers spend hours a week working on it, like year round.
The corollary to that is the fact that it is pre-taped does allow them to draw on a deeper pool of talent.
Yes,
they wouldn't do as much in a live stage, right? Like, it lets them go to people who are maybe VPs or product managers, right, or stuff like that, who aren't going to get up because whether they don't want to or they don't have all that training, like Tim Cook or Eddie Q or somebody like that. And that is great because it lets them improve the diversity of the people presenting and get people who are actually closer to those projects, right? Like, well, there are people who are directly involved with those things rather than be like, hey, Tim or Craig, talk about this, these 100 things, right? Craig could probably use a break, frankly.
And it's much more contextual. We can go to a mountain. We can go into a living room. We can go into, you know, like, so the thing is just from a pure perspective of, we're standing on a black box stage that has a wall behind it, to we can actually take you places where I'm walking dynamic. Or sitting or doing it. It's much more dynamic. Yeah. It's just a much more interesting show. You do have control, but as a viewer, it's far easier to it's far easier to watch, I think. And I think that that's the than the stage events. I find myself almost unable to watch any stage events now. After I've started watching keynotes that came out pre-recorded, the stage events feel like they're going so slow that I'm like, I got to wait until this is VOD so I can watch it at 2x because I can't watch this at regular speed. It's just not moving fast enough.
Although it does bring up the eternal question about here's the difference between a live performance versus a pre-recorded performance. Like even when the Metropolitan Opera does a lot of like live simulcast events, if you can't make it out for Idiomano, you can go to a local theater like once during the month and they'll have a live stream of it. And there is a different energy and a different vibe. And when you think about the really great keynotes of Apple's past, you think about like the first iPhone keynote. When introducing the first iPhone, introducing the first Apple Watch, where it really was about there was an electricity in the room that made everything seem two or three times as interesting as you might have thought it was otherwise. And I'm of two minds about it, where on the one hand, I like as a journalist, I'm like, thank goodness it's no longer like the circus type of atmosphere where why are people cheering for the development of a hardware product for the $1 billion, nearly a $1 trillion company? This is let us know what it's about. Let us know what it does. On the other hand, if the purpose, there's a reason why companies have these events, whether pre-taped or live, instead of just simply issuing a press release and electronic media kit, they really want that kind of excitement around people. They really want people to think that, no, this isn't just another phone. No, this isn't just Apple trying to have a quixotic assault on Nokia and BlackBerry, two titans that are never ever going to be put out of business. If it does it suit Apple's purposes to have that kind of live energy where things are a little bit off but a little bit exciting because you feel as though you're witnessing something that is happening at this moment as opposed to witnessing something that was scripted out, planned out, well lit. Like, do you want a Marvel movie or do you want a play? Do you want a Marvel movie where every single there's a chaotic battle scene where you know that it was the shot was delayed for 3 weeks? Saying, I want to see a little bit more light in Captain America's eyes. And can you have the Black Widow while she's falling off the cliff make eye contact with Hawkeye and just sort of wink a little bit? And I'm wondering how much we're going to lose the energy of these sort of events.
Spoilers for Avengers Endgame, by the way. I think you're right. I have thought for a while now that one possibility was that they would create a hybrid event where they would, and they didn't do this for the iPhone, which now makes me think they never will, which is they do a stage event, but with a lot more videos, right? Where Tim Cook comes out live on stage and says, "Hi, everybody. This is Tim. It's the morning. Good morning." And then let's watch a video of this iPhone. And then he comes back and says, "Look at it. Isn't it amazing?" And he's like, "We've got another product. Let's watch the video." And basically be the MC rolling videos, but you still get the video stuff. But I think the truth is, not only is it technically easier, right, Alex, to preload things in your CDN and not have to do a live stream, but you have complete control and it's good enough. And it is, you're getting people to watch a commercial for 90 minutes.
And the big problem is that when you go back to the stage, the energy drops really far. You know, so you think that we can keep that energy up, but you can't. And so when we've worked on events where they basically went from one movie to the other, and the problem is it jumps to the stage. You're now queuing. You're coming out of a live and you're counting somebody in. So you're going, you know, you're on in 10, 9, 8, you know, like, you know, and they're going to call them in. There's a person that's moving their hand and they're going to point at you right when you're going live, you know, coming out of the video, and then they say their thing and then they go right back into it. But there's something about it. They're uncomfortable. They're on stage. It doesn't, and it just always feels like you fell off into this little trough and go right back into the video. And so every time we've done that, we've thought, oh, let's never do that again.
Yeah.
And so I did think that they might do what you're talking about, but I felt like they'll do it once and then they'll realize this is a horrible idea.
What kept me thinking they might do it was not only do they have the Steve Jobs Theater, they built that thing, but they pack it with VIPs and Apple employees down in the first 20 rows or 10 rows. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones who cheer like mad. And I thought, well, there might be a stagecraft advantage to having the videos like a Saturday Night Live thing. I mean, I keep likening comparing it to Saturday Night Live, especially back in the 80s where they went to there was a producer shift and they went to mostly, I'm showing my age here, but you know, hey, it happened. When Dick Ebersol took over from Lorne Michaels in that brief period before Lorne Michaels came back, they went to pre-taped bits. They did a lot of film, comedy films that they shot during the week with Christopher Guest and Billy Crystal and all of that. And they would play those through with the SNL audience there cheering and laughing a long way. They were a live version of a laugh track, basically. And I thought maybe they could do something like that and take advantage of all that applause, because that is the one thing you lose in watching these Apple films, as they call them, is you lose that kind of hyped up applause that, you know, as a journalist, I wasn't there applauding, but the all the VIPs were. I don't think it's really worth the trade-off, though.
The 300 employees that have been rehearsing for 3 days.
So clap now. Yeah.
But the, you know, and for me, you know, I think that there's the reason to stream, though, is that we do have a unified experience. We're all watching this at the same time.
Yeah.
People are tweeting it. For office hours, 150 of us watch these keynotes together over Zoom. So, and now we don't play it into Zoom. We all watch it on our own device. And then there's just open mic and we all sit there and talk about everything. Now we talk about everything, like all the way down to the camera moves and the, whether that was CG and whether this was whatever.
Sure.
But we also talk about all the releases, and it's really fun to the point where, you know, if I had the opportunity to go to the Steve Jobs Theater, I was like, no,
yeah,
I'd rather just do it with my friends. Well, I'd rather watch it with my friends over Zoom and talk about it than watch it. So I think that there is still a power of the fact that, because you get to a point when you do VOD, like, should we even stream it? Should we just release the video? And I think that there is a real power to releasing the video, to streaming the video out in real time, so that we're all hearing about it at the same time. The press is hearing about it at the same time, because that also creates an intensity for the press, because if it all comes out at the same time, we all have that as well as they, you know, for a long time, Apple didn't want to stream anything. So they kept it all closed. Because they wanted to make sure the press showed up, right? Or that's the rumor. so by not making it available anywhere else, the press would have to come to see what they were doing, and so there was a little bit of time that you had as a press person to get stuff out, you know, and now it's available to everyone. So now it's really short as far as the window goes to say whatever you're going to say about it.
It's the binge versus the weekly drop model of streaming, basically, right? Like the weekly drop gets everybody talking, everyone around the world water cooler. The binge is like that show's already gone and you're on to the next thing.
That's why they've got events through the week, is that you don't want to drop it all on a binge on Monday. You want people saying, oh, I can't wait for that session that'll drop on Wednesday. That CarPlay session on Thursday is going to be hot. We got to wait for Thursday. Can't wait for that drop.
And I have to admit, as someone who is not we're in the press, but I'm not covering everything. I'm interested in very specific things in WWDC.
Sure.
I'm interested in AR and HLS and a couple other things. And like, I don't need to see maps. I'm kind of like, I just want everything at the very beginning, because there's only about 8 or 10 of those. It's not like I watch all of WWDC. There's like 8 or 10 sessions that
the big one is, so
and they're always on Friday.
You mentioned, yeah, the Friday ones are actually, they've kept that tradition from back when it was a real conference, which is the videos on Friday aren't very interesting. All right. We should talk about the VR headset a little bit. A couple of conflicting reports this week. So Ming-Chi Kuo said that the production is going to be slower. They've had some production delays and they're not going to get as many produced in this calendar year. And that made him think they might push back the announcement date. Whereas Mark Gurman at Bloomberg has reported that he's very confident that they're going to announce it. And I think that makes sense, because like, if you think back to the Apple Watch, which was a while ago, it's coming up 10 years, in fact, for the Apple Watch. When the Apple Watch was announced, it was announced in the fall, in September, and released in April, right? It was released a lot later. You can do that the first time you release a product when you're not cannibalizing your sales. They have done this repeatedly. They did this with the iPhone, which was announced in January and shipped in very late June. So I think the most likely scenario is still probably, especially given that this is an entirely new platform that's going to require, it's a new OS, developers are going to need to learn about it. The developer conference is the perfect place to roll it out. And if they don't ship it until the fall sometime, it actually benefits them, because they're going to have a big iPhone event in the fall and they can remind everybody about how amazing this product is, whatever it is, as they're putting it on sale. So there are a lot of advantages to doing it this way. Seems to me like this is the most straightforward approach for them, is still to, even if it's not ready to ship in June.
especially on a first product, Apple's never afraid to delay things. Like they're never afraid. Like there was a WWDC where there was a ton of POP everywhere. I mean, a ton of these posters that all looked a lot like an Apple TV, and there was no Apple
no.
TV.
Seven months between the Apple Watch being announced and shipping, right? Like they didn't even talk about the Apple TV,
and there was graphics all over. It's just obviously
nobody
printed something.
It's the first rule of WWDC is nobody ever talk about the Apple TV. Unfortunately, that's still the rule, and so nobody does. Dan, I wanted to run this by you because you're a veteran of a lot of these Apple events too, which is the demo. How do you do a demo? And of course, Alex and Andy, I want to hear from you too, but I thought I'd go to Dan first. How do you do a demo of a VR headset? If we come out of the Steve Jobs Theater into that lobby area behind, like, surely they can't have a bunch of headsets and have a line of people waiting to put them on and flail around for 5 minutes. I keep coming back to that as a challenge for a product like this, is how do you give members of the press any amount of time to get an impression of what this product is like? It seems like it's a lot easier to put an iPhone in someone's hand.
Yeah, sure. I think this is a challenge of the event itself, too. How do you convince consumers who are watching this thing, and there will be consumers watching, even if it is a developer-focused conference, the amazingness of what this other, you know, metaverse-style VR, AR, you know, environment you're creating. It's like trying to demo 3D technology on a 2D screen, right? You're like, oh, trust me, it's amazing. But, like, fundamentally, it comes down to this idea of, like, you really have to see it and use it in order to kind of get what's happening, I think. And I think all the companies, Meta and Microsoft, have all struggled a little bit with how do you demo this? Because you can do that highly produced video, but then you're watching somebody else use a thing, and it's somewhat strange. It looks very post-processed. You've got this idea like, well, it's all sort of put together and carefully edited. I think when it comes to the press, I have to imagine they may do it a little more structured than it's been in the past. If you go to these events in the past, you end up in a giant room where people are milling around, and there's maybe 20 or 30 of these new devices, whatever they are, and you're sort of jockeying for position. There's people with, you know, cameras who want to like get in there with their broadcast cameras and shoot interminable demos for B-roll for 5 minutes. And you're trying to like, I just want to see how this thing works. Can I just touch this thing? I wonder if they're going to, especially with still, you know, the pandemic stuff has eased a bit, try to, you know, cordon off areas or create little experiences for people to come in and actually try these things in a more structured fashion. So you have a certain amount of time allotted to your use of it. Say, come in for 10 minutes and we'll let you run through these demos and stuff that we have available. And then there's a question as to sort of, you know, how far along is this product? If it is been pushed back a little bit, not everything's probably going to be working perfectly, so they're going to want to make sure it's very controlled in terms of what is the experience you're seeing here. We want to show you the best stuff, the stuff that works really well and the stuff that feels really compelling. And so part of me wonders then, too, is it going to be something more like a demo loop when you put it on? And it's like, all right, here, you can do these four things. Let's walk you through this experience. And I think that's another part of it. They're going to want to make sure it's not just people walking around, putting a headset on and trying a thing, and it immediately breaks. And then they're going to go write a story about how this headset is garbage and et cetera.
Yeah, the Apple Watch, I'm reminded when we got our first look at the Apple Watch, it was literally on a demo loop. You could put it on your hand, on your arm, but it just animated through like a bunch of scenes. It was literally playing a demo, and that was how they controlled it.
I would be surprised if they do have a lot of people putting those headsets on during WWDC. I think that they don't want to be COVID, you know, a COVID super spreader, because like we think that COVID's gone, but I have three friends right now that have COVID again. Like they just, you know, it seems to be like suddenly ramping up again or whatever it is. Not bad, but just it's like the flu. But I think they don't want to be part of that. It really is. Headsets have been really problematic even before COVID. It was like you had to put little covers on them and you'd pull them off and then you hand it to the next person. And it was, you know, it was a little gross. And so I think that that's going to be really hard. I think it's much better off. They're much better off talking about AR, talking about it, having iPads and iPhones showing interactive stuff, and then doing kind of more of the Apple quiet demos that they do in these cities where they've got a couple of these kind of secret rooms in different cities that you can go in and, you know, secret little, you know, apartments that you can go into and experience stuff. And they bring people in very small numbers at different times where they can control it. And it might even be over a week and there's only a couple press people at a time, and they've got, you know, they've got their protocol and they've, they can spend more time, because I think that Apple really wants to handcraft the story with the press, and having people just go through the demoing. I've worked on a lot of these from Glass to Oculus to this, for these promos, and demoing it is the hardest, because you put it on and you suddenly have no control, and like they tap the wrong button and they, there's all these buttons and there's all this stuff, these states that you have to get into. And so I think that it is definitely I think that they're going to be very careful about it. I would be really surprised if I see people putting lots of goggles on at WWDC.
Yeah, it seems to me that the most likely scenario is that you'll get, either it'll be that day, there'll be some appointments and maybe into the next day for press where they'll say, essentially present yourself at the Steve Jobs Theater at 1:15. And you'll be, ushered back. And at 1:30, you'll be given 10 minutes in a room where you'll be instructed about what you're going to do. And then you're out of there after 10 minutes and the next person comes in. Or, especially based on the timing and reading this report from Ming-Chi Kuo, it's also possible that it'll be, we'll call you, we'll set something up later. And that's when it's people on the East Coast will be told to go to their apartment and their flat in Chelsea, and somebody on the West Coast will be told to go to Cupertino, and there'll be other places like that. And it'll still be a, please present yourself and we'll give you 15 minutes in a room for a guided tour, and then that's it. They may have hardware us to look at or even to hold, but it won't work because that doesn't make sense.
I don't think that we should be thinking about this as anything akin to any other product launch demo that Apple's ever done. When there's ample precedent for all the way back to the iPhone, where we're announcing it and showing it off in January, we're not shipping for several months. And even remember with the launch of the iPhone, most people got to see it on the show floor at Macworld and behind this protected
glass column. Yes.
Exactly. And rotating slowly inside like a rotisserie chicken. But as Alex said, some of us were given appointments like after the keynote to get 45 minutes of guided hands-on. Also very, very much told that, I notice you're trying to use the Notepad app. That's just a JPEG.
It's a screenshot.
That's not an actual thing. but it's one of the reasons why I think this has to happen is that there is a point where Apple has to get FCC certification, in which case a lot of the stuff becomes public record. Also, there comes a point in which either you run up to the limits of what you can do by testing out a super, super top secret, double top secret project inside Apple campus and inside certain very, very secure rooms and certain very, very trusted partner companies. There's a point in which you have to allow people to have these outside of campus and see how well they work and work with other people they trust. You have to increase the amount of people that you're letting in on this. But the difference between this and almost everything else is that I don't think anybody, myself included, thinks that this first launch is going to be we've got this brand new product, everybody rush out and buy it. It's, we have this $3,000 thing that is way more expensive than it will ever intend to be, probably is not going to have anywhere near the feature set that we intend the real thing to be. This is advanced hardware for developers who want to get in very, very early on a new app platform, and B, people in the design field, people in the medical field, people in the military field, people in the maintenance and training fields who are willing to spend top dollar for something because they're going to be writing their own bespoke apps for it for their own purpose. So it's perfectly okay for them to announce something knowing that almost nobody that is watching this is going to have a need to actually own this at any specific given time. They can show it off. I think that a lot of what they're going to be showing off is not necessarily hands-on demos. Again, I really think it's just going to be a very, very tight. They're going to have some time again, even with the most trusted people, really very much a demo on rails with a lot of things signed saying, here's what you can talk about the experience, here are things you cannot talk about the experience. But it's not a real release as yet. I think that it really is just going to be something where they can actually, I'm sorry if I'm blathering, but the Adderall shortage is a very real thing.
You're right. It is a tech demo.
But what I wanted to really say is that I really think that what they maybe the most valuable part of the presentation is not necessarily getting 100 or 1,000 people to give a demonstrate to demonstrate and talk about the experience, but basically on video, they've trusted maybe a couple of outsiders. There's always a couple of outside developers they give advanced access to. That's sort of not looking at the camera, but looking just to the right of the camera, saying, when you put it on, I felt as though I saw the future, and not just the future of everything, but my future. And that's the sort of stuff that is suitable for a device that is going to be $1,000 in 2 years from now, but right now it's just going to be a $3,000 developer gear.
Right. I think it's definitely going to be a case where you're going to be told, put this on. Now you're in an environment. Look around. Now reach out with your hand and do this gesture. And then and it'll be like super like scripted and all of that. And that's how it'll have to go.
And the reality is they don't need it. I mean, so they're going to have, let's say 300,000 or 500,000 of these units. At $3,000, they'll sell every one that they make because there'll be enough developers and enough people that want to be on the front end and enough people that want to have the first of everything or whatever it is to buy such a – that's a very small lot for Apple. And so the reality is that a lot of the news that's going to come out, they're not trying to excite people to buy 40 million of these or 20 million of these.
Right.
They're only going to be able to produce enough to support the people who are – going to buy them anyway. So I don't think that they're going to – you know, I think that that's going to be – all of those will be spoken for. I bet you – if they put them on sale, which I don't think they will at a WWC, I think they'll talk about a WWC. I think they'll put it on sale in the fall. But if they put it on sale, they'll be sold out in, you know, within a day.
Well, the challenge is going to be, and it sounds like they're going
to
be limited, right? Like that's the, I think Ming-Chi Kuo's report is very much like they're going to be manufacturing them and it's going to take time. But I do think that the goal here is more to get people excited about the future and to counteract perceptions of it being a flop. Now, Leo's not here to do his Leo thing that we could say, which is, I think it's going to be a disaster and a flop and nobody wants it. But like, I mentioned this on the show last week, I feel like there's a lot of expectation setting going on already where it's sort of like, but it's not really for everybody and it's not going to sell that well and it's a slow build like the Apple Watch and that's okay. And I think that any other kind of messaging they do this summer is going to be in that line, which is like Andy said, wow, this is a glimpse of the future and not the usual sort of like, we got to get everybody out there to buy their iPhone and line up and make your orders now because we're going to sell a lot of iPhones. It's not that kind of product launch. It is about managing expectations, not letting it be seen as a dud because they really do want to build on this year after year after year. And it's a tricky challenge because this doesn't happen to Apple very often, if ever in this way. So it's going to be interesting.
I'm kind
to
of
see.
50-50 on even if they'll discuss the price. If it's not shipping for a couple of months, part of me wonders if they'll just kick that hand down the road. But the other part of me thinks there's been so much written about that $3,000 figure that if they want to the number of stories that are going to come out like the next day, like, but they didn't tell us how much it costs. It's still going to be $3,000. And I don't know. I don't know how they want to handle that, whether they want to put a stake in the ground and be like, hey, this is the price, or just be like, we're not going to talk about that until shipping.
Or you wonder, going back to what Jason's talking about, how much they've ginned up themselves of the expectation of $3,000. They come out and it's $23.99. Everyone's like, it's almost free.
How do you convince people that a headset that costs $2,500 is a deal? And the answer is make them all think it's going to be $3,000.
Yep.
Or more.
Remember, we have precedent with this for the iPad.
Yeah.
Everybody in the room was sure it's going to be $1,000. That, oh my God, it's a device that we don't know what it does. And even Steve Jobs isn't really clear on why anybody would own it. But it's $400 less than we thought it was going to be. Yay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Not
right.
Nothing.
I think they've done it again.
I think they have definitely inflated that price. That number has so consistently been bandied about that I can't help but think they're going to beat it. I don't know how low, but it's going to come in under $3,000.
Yeah, would not surprise me at all. This is an outlier, and I know the answer is probably no because Apple never does this, but part of me wonders if part of their messaging is actually going to be about the future, since this is a future product, in order to say this is going to be a product line. This is Apple Reality Pro. There are going to be other products in the future. Essentially a way for them to say, look, they're not all going to cost $3,000, right? Because the reports are that they are working on a consumer version of this, a more consumer. I don't even know what to call this, label these products, but a cheaper version. Let's just say it. A cheaper version of this that regular people might actually consider buying. And I wonder if there's a way for them to spin it to sort of like say, we know that you're not going to spend, you know, $3,000, but it's okay because next year or in the near future, you'll be able to get one that's much more reasonably priced than this unreasonable. I mean, again, they're going to Apple it up, but that's what they're going to try.
I just got it. I just got it. They're going to call this the Lisa.
Amazing.
Apple VR Lisa. Yeah. And so when the $10,000 one becomes the $2,500 one in 2 years from now, they're going to say, my God, the geniuses at Apple managed to get this down to.
Well, if it has Pro in the title, which is that rumor that it's Apple Reality Pro, the brilliance of that is it implies there will be a non-Pro version at some point, right? And that's pretty good. That's a pretty good move.
The HomePod Mini to the HomePod coming version. Back.
Yeah, how is it that you have a Pro variation of a product that doesn't exist? That's weird. And they're like, well, yeah, it is strange, isn't it? Weird. We left this whole like empty square here with nothing in it. I wonder what that could be. Maybe that's what they'll do.
And I think that the big thing is the real challenge for Apple and what's been the challenge for all of these devices is not whether the device is cool or whether it can do what it says it's going to do. It's the content. You know, so what are they going to, you know, and so they have to really get the content ginned up. Now there's a, you know, they've been, by doing AR stuff with the phone and the iPad and everything else, they've been able to do a lot of things that are going to help lay the groundwork. People understand AR. They understand USDZ. They understand a lot of these reality bits and pieces. And so people have been playing with it for a while. They've been getting people used to that. They've probably been talking to a lot of vendors. So I think that the way, how do you get people to believe it is when they get up there and they go, here are our partners and there's you know, Home Depot and Amazon and, you know, in addition to like all these other things showing like, how, cause like Amazon, what I'm always amazed at in Home Depot and Amazon, I think it's Home Depot, one of them, but Amazon has this thing, like when you're on your phone and you go to a piece of furniture, it says, hey, would you like to look at that in your living room? And you're like, oh yeah, I'll look at it. Boom. It just pops right in. And I'm like, well, that's going to be really much more interesting when I put goggles on and look at it.
But,
so
yeah, I've always said the biggest issue, Apple spent interminable time in previous keynotes talking about AR and people holding iPads, looking at tables and, ooh, this is amazing. Look at all these virtual things. And it's like fundamentally like peeking in through a window. And being like, oh, let me look around inside that house in that virtual environment over there. But again, it falls that flat because it's got that same sort of viewing 3D in a 2D like context sort of situation where it's just like, okay, I can see like peeking inside this immersive environment. But if the whole point is it's immersive, I want to be in that environment. And that is the kind of stuff.
But I think that that's what we're getting to, you know.
Right. Yeah. That's what makes it compelling.
Yeah. I mean, we built when we were doing a lot of stuff with, a variety of Oculus stuff and with Samsung's goggles, we had a motion capture system. And so we built a 30 by 30 space where you could just walk around and that could be a showroom for all kinds of things. Once you put your headset on, you could just walk around and that was a showroom for cars. We had Shona artwork from Zimbabwe and they looked like huge statues that were, you could walk around and look at as if you were going through a thing. And the thing is that we were like, well, this will be everywhere. But the problem is that the technology wasn't there. That was 10 years ago. And the technology wasn't, you know, the stuff that Google was putting into the phones wasn't even available on Google's own phones. I mean, it was maybe 8 years ago or whatever. And all of that was really exciting, but the tools weren't there yet. And I think what's different now is we're coming into it where the LiDAR is working, a lot of the other bits and pieces are working. The one thing that we haven't really dealt with is that we're barely using ultra wideband. And that's super useful when it comes to being able to do all this stuff. And so there's a bunch of technologies that I think Apple is slowly putting into all this hardware and all the stuff that's already out there, as well as what's coming on to learn how to make it work. I do think that they have a really good opportunity. And I think that whenever they release it, that what's different from Apple and Google is that we know for the next 10 years, Apple's going to work on this. Like they're not going to, you know, this isn't going to be like, oh, you know, 2 years ago we released this, we were really excited about it, but we're going to go ahead and end of life it, you know, because that's what, you know, and so whatever happens for developers, they know that if they get into it, there's going to be something going on for X amount of time. But I think that hopefully, and we've talked about this before, hopefully Apple learned from iBooks that you really need a lot of content like that proves what you can do and not just leave it up to the market to figure it out.
Another advantage of the announcing it in June and then not shipping it for a while is the ability to then out in the open. And I believe this. I mean, I'm a real big believer, and I know I've said it on the show before, that you got to ship the product and that you're going to learn a lot, because the real world will teach you all sorts of things that you know, inside the ring at Apple Park is 100%. Not going to teach you. But the other thing that can happen is, once it's out in the open, once you can talk about the operating system and you can talk about the features that you've pre-announced, and you can then go to a whole wider circle of people and say, are you going to develop? Can you port? Can we get your 3D content from your movie? All of that stuff starts to happen. And they will, once you open the doors, right? And in June, they open the doors. And if they're not shipping the product until late in the summer or into the fall, then it's just going to give them so much more freedom to make those deals, to show it off to people, and to make the product, when it does arrive, that much richer in terms of the content. So I think it's a real advantage to pre-announcing a new product is take that time.
And I think that the MLS partnership, along with the purchase of NextVR, is going to get really interesting.
Yeah, get that.
You know, because
just be standing right on the sidelines there.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is that it has been, so I've done a lot of that too on those things, and dealing with the broadcast rules and all the other, the broadcasters and what we're allowed to post and what we're not allowed to post. The easiest way to be able to put VR into a system is to own the entire broadcast so that you don't have to deal with what the NBC rules are, or how NBA relates to this, or how the NFL wants to deal with content. Like, all of that went away. And Apple can do whatever they want, and that and they're going to be able to show all the other sports networks and all the other, you know, verticals using something that they were able to buy out. This is what we could do with VR.
I had an amazing experience. I got a press release sitting at my desk. I got a press release that was about an NBA experience in on the MetaQuest. They're like, we got a fresh new VR experience for the NBA on TNT or whatever, and the first premiere of it is today at 8 Eastern. And I looked at my clock and it was 4:50 Pacific. I'm like, oh my God, that's right. So I went and I got my MetaQuest, and I put it on, my Quest 2, put it on. I had to update software and download things and log in and go to this place. And I'm finally I enter the NBA portal. And you know what it was? It was a virtual bleachers and a big screen TV showing the game that was on TNT. I'm like, what? What? And I know they've done some experiments where you're like sitting on the bench or sitting right next to the bench, but the press release was like, no, come at 8 p.m. Eastern. You're going to get the full VR experience. And obviously the VR experience they were allowed to present was the game on TV in VR. Less interesting to me than maybe. But again, I think that had something to do with the rights and the availability. And I mean, Alex, you know this too. It's the equipment, right? Like you actually have to have specialized equipment and have
it. It's getting the rights to where you put the equipment too. So one side of the, when you talk about the NBA, one side of the court is $2,000 a seat. So whoever's not
sitting there,
somebody's willing to give up the seat. And on the other side is the press side. And then the press doesn't want you to have your camera in the way. And then you put your camera up there, and the main thing, and we've put them right on the right at the mid court, and at that level, the problem is you put them at eye height, and now you're in front of people, and then they complain about it. And but if you get it to where it needs to be, it feels, I mean, it does feel great. I mean, it's a great experience to have when you see those things, but it's hard to get your camera in the right, you know, in the right place where someone's not complaining about it, or that it's going to get hit. I mean, the camera that I was using was a $60,000 camera, and I'm putting it there, and I'm like, you know, if it gets hit with a basketball, I'm going to be super bummed.
Yeah, Drake. So Drake is just, you know, really mad that you're sitting in his seat. Like, Drake, get out of there. He wants to see the Raptors.
I mean, the only place you can put it is really where the press sits, and that's the problem. Is it's sitting in front of the people who
are trying to cover
the
game
to be there. And they're trying to cover the game, and they're not happy.
Yeah. One more item about AR and VR before we move on. We'll take a break and move on. But before we do that, Tim Cook appears in the Gentleman's Quarterly, GQ, a Tim Cook interview. Mostly things that we've heard from Tim Cook before, although full credit to the author of this piece. It's a very well-written piece. I recommend it to people. Zach Barron did a great job. He gets it. It's a rare broad media piece about Apple that I think he doesn't go down the rabbit holes that we all go down, but it's clear that he knows what's down them, right? Like he will make asides and I'll be like, oh yeah, that is a perfect way to blunt the, but you didn't mention. He's like, oh, he knows about it. Yeah. And then he goes on. It's just, it's very artfully done. As has been pointed out by several people, he also, Zach Barron, asked Tim Cook about his statement in the Google Glass era about how AR and VR were, you know, not so great. And he had the best, I mean, the most apple-y, but also the best response to that, which is, you know, Steve Jobs told me that sometimes you need to change your mind. You shouldn't hold on to old opinions. You should change your mind. And it's like, on one level, that is the best way whenever confronted with anything that you're now denying to just say, no, I changed my mind. At the same time, I'm also reminded that we live in a society where a lot of people, especially politicians, but a lot of people in business as well, will never, ever, ever admit that they changed their mind about anything. They'll just double down on the thing they already know is wrong because that they will show weakness. And this is a Steve Jobs maxim that I think is really great, which is, you know, the famously Steve Jobs, once given evidence to show that he was wrong, would be like, boom, I'm on the other side now. And with Steve, I think it was like, and I really was always here. But still, Steve has learned that particular jujitsu from Steve Jobs and used it in the GQ interview.
Yeah. I thought that did. One of the things that kind of disappointed me is that, boy, Steve has been gone for a long, long time. An interview with the CEO of Apple should no longer be one third about Steve and what Steve taught him and what Steve's legacy was and how a certain thing makes Tim think about what Steve told him a while ago. I'm sure that I get the impression from Tim Cook that this is because of a genuine fondness, as opposed to he knows that he's got a golden ticket to parry pretty much anything he wants to parry off. But that also brings up another thing that I really, really liked about this interview, and that you're right. It was very well written. This reporter was not at all dazzled. He was sensitive and savvy enough to be able to impart where, okay, here's where Tim is parrying something off here. And here's where he's being a little bit evasive. And also little details like, well, he was wearing an Apple Watch, but during all the times that we talked, he didn't look at it even once. Little details that give you, if even when the subject of an interview is well coached enough and well practiced enough not to say anything that reveals more than they want to reveal, a really good interviewer observes and notes things that are going to they don't know that they're revealing about themselves. So yeah, it was a very, 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 very good interview. Also, I was very pleased. GQ, like I didn't see the usual like captions because I didn't read it in the print version. Of course, I read it online. But when you go to the bottom, you do see the fashion credits. His jacket by Tom Ford, his shirt by Brioni, jeans by Levi's, glasses throughout his own. A watch is the Apple Watch Ultra. The shirt is by Kiton. The shirt also by Kiton. Shirt by Kiton. He really likes that brand. Pants by Page. Belt by Nordstrom. Boots by Berluti. Watch also the Apple Watch series.
Amazing how they got that out. All that Apple Watch for him to wear, like, whew,
there you go,
lucky guy.
Don't know what scent was he wearing. That's the only thing I was missing out on.
We'll have to follow up. The other thing I wanted to mention, there's a hilarious question because again, this writer is very knowledgeable. He's done his homework at the very least. Says, hey Tim, how about that story where a guy across the table from you in a meeting said we have a problem in China, and then like 5 minutes later you look up and at him and say, why are you still here? And he immediately goes to the airport and flies to China. Is that a real story? And Tim Cook's response is amazing. He's basically like, I mean, yeah, that happened. Sure, he's still here. He runs operations. Yeah. And I just love,
I hear his vacuum cleaner in the hallway.
Yeah,
now.
I love the dynamic of, hey Tim, here's a legendary story about you. And Tim responding with the verbal equivalent of the shrug emoji, just like, yeah.
That is the thing that does make me feel like Tim Cook, you know, it does convey a degree of authenticity and genuineness to Tim Cook. Is like,
he's that guy.
Yes. He's a politician. He's going to say things, but at the end of the day, it feels like he's kind of what you see is what you get, right? Like, yeah. I think there is a large degree of him that is just the attitude, whatever PR has done to sort of corral him is kind of lean into who he is already. And he doesn't really try to make out that he is anything other than that. So, yeah, that is what I mean. Yeah.
while that may be a legendary story, I think the other thing that kind of communicated was that kind of conversation may happen often.
All the time.
And the guy's just part of doing business, right?
Deal,
but that's what we do. You know, like that's how we play really hard. And, mm-hmm. and that's what it looks like. Yeah.
He's still here. I mean, because some people can interpret that as like you yelled at him and you sent him to China and he never came back. Right. And he's like, no, right. He runs operations now. He's like, he's just a guy.
I didn't know if that was the first time we had Sabi Khan, who is actually an SVP, like, you know, and is a name. Like I'd heard that story before, but never with that name attached. Yeah. It's like, yeah, that is is still a very significant player at Apple. So clearly that's the way you get in Tim's good graces, right? Like he says, go, you're like, my bag's packed. I'm gone.
Yeah. I mean,
I think that's a cultural thing all the way through the company. I don't think it's just Tim that's like that. I think that there's a lot of people at Apple, like, you know, we're going to do whatever's necessary to have this, whatever that is. Cause there's, you know, the specificness of the campus and everything it's not just one person.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes from the top. It emanates from the top, but it's been there for a long time.
That's why for me, it was so telling. And you can either read it that it's a famous story that has taken on a life. And yet when you really look at it and examine it from Tim Cook's perspective, it's just not a big deal. It's a thing that they do. You could view it that way, or you can view it as an outsider as being, yeah, I know we all think that this is ridiculous, but this is what they do. And either way is a valid reading of that. But it was a wonderful moment of like, Tim, famous story. How do you feel about this? And he's like, yeah, what? I don't even understand why you're asking me about it. Like, it's amazing.
Well, it's very different in the sense that, you know, I there's a story of a Steve Jobs, you know, firing people very quickly, you know, like, yes. You know, asking
in elevators,
like, what do you do for me? Yeah. What do you do for me? And you bad answer means you're fired. I asked someone who was at Pixar about that. And they go, oh, I've been fired three times. Yeah. There's a person that walks behind Steve that just goes,
it's fine. Yeah. The unfirer, the HR person who's like, no, that's not that unfirer. That person, I think that person may work at Twitter now. the unfirer. All right. A lot of AR talk. We're going to move on to some other topics. I'm going to get mad about CarPlay. We're going to imagine things about the Apple Watch. But first, Leo, I know he's probably spelunking in a cave somewhere in Europe right now looking for the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant or something like that. But before he left, he has some messages for all of us to listen to. Leo?
Let me interrupt MacBreak Weekly just for a minute to tell you about a brand new sponsor, Cisco Meraki, the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work. Whether your employees are working at home, at a cabin in the mountains, lucky employees, on a lounge chair at the beach, or like me, on a cruise, a cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are. You may as well roll out the welcome mat because hybrid work is here to stay. Hybrid work works best in the cloud and has its perks for both employees and leaders. Yes, workers can move faster and deliver better results with a cloud-managed network. Leaders can automate distributed operations, build more sustainable workspaces, and proactively protect the network. An IDG MarketPulse research report conducted for Meraki highlights top-tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. Hybrid work is a priority, we find, for 78% of C-suite executives. Leaders want to drive collaboration forward while staying on top of or even boosting productivity and security. Hybrid work also has its challenges. Absolutely. The IDG report raises the red flag about security, noting that 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. Always on security monitoring. That's part of what makes the cloud managed network so awesome. See, IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners, turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud platform for asset tracking, location analytics, and more to gather insights on how people use their workspaces. In a smart space, environmental sensors, for instance, can track activity and occupancy levels to stay on top of cleanliness. You can reserve workspaces based on vacancy and employee profiles. That's hot desking, right? It allows employees to scout out a spot in a snap. Locations in restricted environments can be booked in advance, and time-based door access can be included. Mobile device management, integrating devices and systems. That allows IT to manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices even when the device and employee are in a remote location. So turn any space even this lovely cruise ship I'm on, into a place of productivity and empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work with Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. That's meraki.cisco.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting MacBreak Weekly. And of course, your support means you go to that address, right? So they know you saw it here, meraki.cisco.com/twit. Now back to the show.
Thank you, Leo. Beaming in. I beamed in to replace Leo. I didn't know that he was on a cruise again. That guy is an inveterate cruiser. I've been on cruises with Leo, too. Life of the party, let me tell you. Okay, Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, who I, for my money, is the best connected regular reporter about Apple. He has good sources. He had them when he was at 95 Mac. He has them now at Bloomberg. Big surprise. Bloomberg, like, didn't tear off his sources. He's got really good sources.
That was a good buy for Bloomberg. That was a good investment.
It really was. I mean, he was literally a college kid. He was at the University of Michigan and writing at 95 Mac. And then he went from there to Bloomberg being the lead reporter on Apple, the most important, powerful, expensive, whatever company in the world. Pretty good move. Good job, Mark Gurman. I like him. He's a good guy. Gets invited to Apple events sometimes, too, which is kind of funny considering. Anyway, Mark Gurman's report this week says, WatchOS 10 coming out or being announced at WWDC will bring notable changes to the Apple Watch user interface. And on Twitter, he said, I believe the new WatchOS should be a fairly extensive upgrade. Notable changes to the user interface. Now, in his report on Bloomberg.com, he also says the hardware probably won't be much of a refresh this fall. It's going to be a fairly light year for the Apple Watch hardware. And as a result, they're trying to pump it up with big software changes instead in WatchOS 10. And not to spring it on all of you, but I was wondering, what would be a notable change to WatchOS at this point? It is, right? Like, what can we imagine? Can any of you imagine what there is that would be ripe for a notable WatchOS change? I'm curious.
One thing. Developers can develop their own watch faces.
Oh, my gosh.
And he stole it.
100%.
That was it.
Imagine. Imagine. Well, the watch face really is... Like having,
it's,
I mean, like eight years
you
of wearing this
the
thing,
interface.
The face is the most important thing, right?
Yeah.
Everything else is gravy. I mean, they've tried a whole bunch of stuff to try and get you to use different parts of the Apple Watch. They've got the dock, and now in the Ultra, they've got the action button and, you know, all this stuff, complications, all these things. But I think fundamentally what changes is 90% of the time your Apple Watch is on the watch face. So if you can't do anything with that, it's a non-starter. So I think any major change has to start there.
And there's so much customization that a lot of us would love to do, like just lay things out that are not just changing the complications. You know, like there's a lot more to designing, you know, something that's clean, that's something that's, you know, that can work and things that will step outside of some of the rules. Like, for instance, Atomic Clock is something that I use and it's on the phone. And there's an app on the watch and it will show up on the watch as a watch face. And it shows all the seconds, which is really important when you're in production, is I want to be able to have my watch and look down at the seconds, but it turns off after a very short period of time. And I actually pinged them and they were like, yeah, it's not us. Like Apple turns the seconds off. And I'm like, here's the deal. I have a big watch I paid a lot of money for. I don't care if it lasts for 2 hours. Like if in the 10 minutes that I'm getting ready for my pre-show, I just want to say, hey,
exactly.
I want to turn it on and leave it on. And I'll burn up the battery for it. Now, give me a warning before I tap on it and say, yes, I don't want to do anything else for 30 minutes or whatever it is. And so I think that for me, that's the number one thing is being able to see seconds is a big deal for me and being able to have. But more importantly, exactly what Andy said, which is watch faces. Like it's all I care about now at this point. All I care about Apple changing on the watch. I mean, everything else is like, sure, like whatever you want to do, but just give me watch faces.
Yeah. One of the very few problems of the Apple Watch, I think, is that there really is a sameness about it where. I'm struggling for the way to put it that isn't stronger than I mean it to be, but it's like you feel a watch is a piece of your own style. It's a piece of your own expression of who you are, what your tastes are, what your drives are. And to an extent, if you have a watch, you're just another person with an Apple Watch. You can change the bands. That's great. That's great. Some of us have the Disney face. That's also great. But there's something about I've decided that thank you for the 80 million complications that allow me to track my health and save my life. I really just want a kitty and the time. And the kitty changes, what the kitty looks like changes over the course of the day. And at night, it's a sleeping kitty. And yeah, I don't have to defend that. It's like just something where it gives me joy the twice an hour in which I take a look at this watch face. It's one of the few advantages that Android Wear has, or Wear OS has, over Watch OS, probably the only advantage that it has, really. And there's also the ability, there's also the opportunity for people who are in certain lines of work where I work in construction. One of the most surprising markets for the Ultra is that there are people who work in construction. They work, they're loggers. They're very, very physical laborers who need a very, very durable watch. And these are basically on the watches, on the wrists of a lot of heavy equipment operators. Imagine if someone, a developer who is also, again, a heavy equipment operator, created a watch face that is not just customizable with complications, but is designed so that when you look at the time, you are also getting an alert. You're also getting alert to things that only you in the cockpit of a huge bulldozer would want to know about, or only somebody who is working in an academic environment would always want to know about. Again, it just seems like such an obvious thing. I'm surprised that they haven't done it by now. The fact that there are so many really clever hacks making use of, well, I can have a picture as the background, so I can maybe make it kind of look like it's an old-fashioned Casio calculator watch, which is what I want, or I can use the animation to basically fake something, this, that, and the other. When someone is going through all that effort to pretend to have a feature, that's a good time to look into actually adding that feature.
Yeah, it's the developer, David Smith. Has been experimenting, very talented developer of Watch Smith and Widget Smith, among other things. And he, in his spare time, basically writes watchOS apps that are watch faces, which you know, can't be really used as watch faces other than while the app is running. But it gives him, I think, pleasure to do this design, and it shows that it can be done. And I agree. I think that the watch face is so central to watchOS that the number one thing that I thought of was customizable third-party developer watch faces. And for people who are like, well, isn't that an intellectual property concern because there are trademarks? Like, everything goes through the App Store, folks. Like, Apple could have a rigorous watch face approval process, and then we get to have all sorts of controversies where we complain about why did this get rejected or why did this get accepted, and that's all fun too. But they can exert control over it while allowing people to do some brilliant things that perhaps Apple has been reluctant to do in the past, or has just not thought of or not prioritized. It has always felt that the people working on watchOS watch faces was a very small group of people who probably didn't have enough funding, quite frankly. It's a very limited supply. So saying maybe we could outsource this and get some more watch faces in the App Store seems like a good thing. The thing I would throw out that's watch face related also is complication related. I feel like complications are the place, because I have a lot of watch OS apps. Complications are the place where my apps surface, where they peek through. Like I interact with them more by looking at them in a face as a complication than I do actually operating those apps. And they don't update very often. And that's a legacy of the early days of the Apple Watch when it didn't really have any processing power, but they still don't update as often as they probably could or should. They're not interactive in any way. There's probably at least some ability that would be nice to interact with them without having to go launch the app and then use the app. A very brief, whether it's a swipe or a tap to change the view or something like that. And then dynamic complications was the other thing that I thought of, which is the example I keep giving is, you know, I want to see my running timer when it's running, but I don't want to leave a complication up for the timer app all the time. That's ridiculous. And yet right now complications sort of have to either be on or off all the time, instead of it being, you know, this time of day, do this, or in this context, do this. And I'd love to see more of that.
Apple tried to sort of briefly forestall that when it added that Siri watch face that's supposed to figure stuff out, but then they kind of just let it sit there forever, and it never really changed again. So I think they decided maybe that's not the way to handle this problem.
It has to want to change, Dan. That's the problem with the Siri watch face.
Siri does not want to change.
It has to want to change. You can't change it for you. It has to want to change first.
It is an interesting problem, though, because Apple really can't change the hardware at all at this point. They've got the scrolly thing, they've got the push button thing, they've got the haptic response, and they've got a square screen, and they really can't change anything else about that for risk of having bifurcating the platform and creating two classes of users. And there's also the question of what would they add to the mechanical interface. I mean, they really did kind of get it right. I don't prefer a square dial. I really do like the round dials of Wear OS. If Apple created a round dial, I think that would be such class, such a cool bit of coolness. But yeah, they really have to do stuff with software. And they've also been smart enough for the past X years to realize that this isn't a productivity device. This really is a fashion device and a fitness device. So I think that whatever changes they make to the UI is going to have to reflect that.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised Mark Gurman saying that there's not going to be major hardware changes. I sort of figured that they might follow up the Apple Watch Ultra with a version of the regular Apple Watch with the action button. You talk about your one major change to the Apple Watch hardware since it debuted is this one new button on the Ultra, a hardware button dedicated to a specific function. Although when I talk to people who use the Apple Watch Ultra, I sense some frustration, the fact that it's got to be hardwired to a single thing. Again, no context. It can't be used by apps to do something within the app. It really needs to be one thing wherever you are, which is kind of a bummer, right? You've got the crown, you've got the side button, you've got the action button on the Ultra, but they're all kind of like dedicated to be one thing all the time, and it's a little bit frustrating. I would love an action button on the regular Apple Watch as well, because it's just one. Hardware buttons are good. Like, I mean, this is the debate. I know it's come up here before too, but like touchscreens in cars, right? Like, you can't make everything a touchscreen. Hardware buttons are good. Hardware dials are good. Being able to do something by feel, the worst. Okay. Everybody can fight me. The worst iPod Apple ever released was that third generation iPod where they replaced the physical buttons with those four touch sensitive buttons at the top above the scroll wheel, where if you were trying to navigate by feel, well, guess what? You touched it and it would just fire off. And like
better or worse than the iPod Shuffle with no buttons?
Oh, well, that is a Zen, Dan, that is a Zen question of whether the bad buttons or no buttons is worse or better. But yeah, anyway, so physical buttons are good. Adding another physical button to the Apple Watch, good. You know, this goes with the reports that I know we talked about last week that the ring switch on the iPhone in a future version, perhaps this fall, will be replaced with a button. And that the possibility is that button could be assigned like, you know, to an accessibility feature or some other feature, and not necessarily just the silent mode switch that currently exists. I love that idea. Like, give me physical buttons that I can feel. They have a place, even though Apple has seemingly tried over the last 20 years to remove as many ports and buttons from their products as possible. The war on buttons continues, is what I'm saying. Bring it back. The action button is the first crack in the war on buttons we've had in a long time, I think.
Returned.
That's good. Let's get in there. More buttons. Here's a story that I found interesting and infuriating, which is General Motors very proudly this week announced that they're going to get rid of their support for CarPlay and Android Auto on their EVs by standardizing on an Android Automotive, which is not the same as Android Auto because it's a base operating system that runs on the car, whether you've got a phone or not, Android Automotive-based subsystem. But as a part of that, they're saying they're going to take phone projection, essentially CarPlay and Android Auto, out of the equation. And therefore,
I think they did us all a big favor. Because now I don't have to look at GM cars ever again.
Yeah.
like I don't even have to consider them. Like, the chances of me buying a car without AirPlay is zero. Without CarPlay. I'm sorry, without CarPlay is zero. Zero. Like not even minus. It's like me making fun of people who it's like in the negatives, because I'll make fun of people like, oh, it doesn't have AirPlay. No, it doesn't have CarPlay, does it? You know, like it'll just be this like mockingness of like, why would you buy a car that can't connect to your phone?
Feels,
you
know, they ran over their foot to spite their face or something.
With their own car.
With their own car, just backed right over themselves. Yeah. I don't. Yeah. I don't understand this decision.
Apple said last year at the WWDC that what 70-some-odd% of people said it was important to them that their next new car purchase have CarPlay. 70-some percent. Now, when the rubber meets the road, I feel like all the car metaphors are going to come out now. Will it be enough? Not having CarPlay, will it be enough to do it? I don't know, but the arrogance that I see that car companies are like, yes, we're going to take this back because what's more important, the software that runs on your car or the software that runs on the phone that's in your pocket 24/7 and that you use for everything and the apps that are on it? Because I'm talking to somebody who knows a lot about the car industry. I found out that Android Automotive, you will be able to install Android apps. They have to be in the Play Store and they have to be in the automotive flag, basically, has to be set for that app. But again, if you use an app that's not in there or that doesn't have the flag set as your podcast app, let's say, and you've got an iPhone, like, it's too bad. And it's essentially GM saying, well, no, you need to choose a podcast app that works with your car because your car is the most important thing, and a music app that works with your car because the car software is the most important thing. And then when I get a new phone with a new operating system upgrade that does cool new things, will my car have those new things? Probably not, right? The track record of updating car software is pretty low, but I guess we'll see.
If they've got Android, if you can run an Android app, you're even going further and just sort of taking off iPhone users. And why would you want to take off iPhone users, who are people with generally a lot of disposable income, who are probably more likely to buy a new car in the first place, and especially an EV? I mean, it's a big chunk of your market, and it feels like, again, why are you doing this to yourself? Why are you running into yourself over and over?
It's an opportunity. Unfortunately, if they use CarPlay and Android Auto, again, it's important that to note that they 86'd every solution where, hey, the apps are running on your phone,
yes,
running with a dumb screen. They want all that data. They don't want to share that data with Android automaker, with a CarPlay maker. They want to see all the transactions that are being made through your phone. They want to collect all that data, bundle all that data, monetize all that data. And if they could have licensed iOS, they would have, as their in-car data surveillance subsystem, they would make that an option maybe. But because they can simply grab Android for free, or even better, basically get a huge payment from Google to say, guess what? We're going to put Android. So guess what? You also get to have the advantage of getting a peek into how people are driving their cars and what apps they're using and what things that you could sell at them at that point. Yeah, it's obvious why they're doing that. It's yet another, up there with the $12 a month for heated seats. It's another way, yes, of just degrading the consumer experience because there's a huge profit motive that is not going to help them, but doesn't help the consumer.
Key data point here from GM's statement. We do believe there are subscription revenue opportunities for us, said the chief digital officer at GM in announcing this. Now, GM, of course, behind OnStar, which was a previous subscription opportunity where they wired cell modems into cars and charged you a monthly fee for things like GPS tracking or making phone calls, which really got hit by everybody having smartphones. You kind of didn't need that anymore. So this is a new opportunity to lock you in and pay for features using this. They say that the navigation features will be free for the first 8 years you own the car. That'll be great for resale value. People are going to love that part of it too. Also, I should give voice to their excuse, which is, we have a lot of new driver assistance features coming that are more tightly coupled with navigation. We don't want to design these features in a way that are dependent on a person having a cell phone. And I know it seems ridiculous that somebody wouldn't have a cell phone, but there are lots of scenarios where you lose your phone, or you're having somebody park your car, or you're leaving it at the airport parking and they have to valet it somewhere, or there are lots of scenarios where you can't have a car that doesn't work unless a paired smartphone is nearby. But that's not the same as at all at what they're describing here, which is, no, we're also not going to let your smartphone appear in a window in our user interface. And as for navigation, it would be very easy for a car maker to say, well, we have the nice navigation that has all information about all the battery status and where the chargers are, and we're going to do our self-driving features, and they're all tied together. And if you want to use any of that, you need to use our navigation and not Google Maps on your phone. Fair enough. But instead, they're using that as an argument to never be able to use Google Maps phone.
And the problem is because there'd be no uptake. I mean, if we can do Google Maps or Apple Maps, or we can use our Android phone or app or iPhone, I don't even think about the interface in a car. That I rent cars and I don't even think about those interfaces. I'm taking over, you know? And so the thing is that I don't have any. And so the problem is that they're in a situation where they can't even roll those features out because no one cares. Like, no one cares about their features anymore. And the hard part that the automotive industry is going to have is that no one really cares about cars anymore. So the thing is, it's not no one, but a shrinking supply there's a shrinking supply of consumers who really care about the car, because the car is a pain in the neck when you're trying to surf all the time. So when you're on your phone, I have kids that aren't interested in driving. They're like, that's a pain in the neck, because now I can't be talking to my friends, you know, texting with my friends or on whatever if I'm in a car, you know. And so I don't think that the future is, you know, they have to figure out how to make this all work. I can see why they're doing it. I just think that making this announcement, you know, I do think there's a large portion of the population that will just go, well, GM's not one of the options that I have when I go to buy a car anymore. Like, it's just off, you know? I think that it's nice for them to tell us that ahead of time, so we don't get surprised they're taking it away. But I think that for people like me, I wasn't really planning to buy a Chevrolet anytime soon anyway. So I'm not dying from, you know, over the thing, but I would definitely, and you know, Apple and Google are making their own cars. And I think that part of it is you're giving data to them, letting them figure a bunch of stuff out that you can't do. And, you know, I think that there might be a concern that eventually those cars will be the ones that everyone wants to use, because they don't want to drive the car. They want to sit in the back and let it take them wherever they're going to go. And I think that's part of the problem too.
I think fundamentally the car companies are also not good at this. They are bad at the software development stuff. It's not in their wheelhouse, so to speak. There's a good argument in a good article in The Verge today that was talking about some of this, as well as talking about the Cadillac's failed Q infotainment system maybe 10 years ago or so. And it was so bad that it basically tarnished that brand, you know, as a result. And yet GM is back here trying to take a second bite at that apple. And it's really strikes me as somebody who, you know, I was talking to Jason, and I were talking about this a while back and somewhere else, but I wrote a piece maybe a decade ago when I bought my car about how bad the interface was in the car. Like, and it had a system where you could connect stuff or put stuff on a, you know, a SD card and put it in MP3s on an SD card, or it had Bluetooth or whatever. And it just, the interface was broken. It didn't work well. And like, you buy a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 car and feel like this system is bad, but I am stuck with it. Like, the best thing that ever happened to some of these car companies were the invention of Android Auto and CarPlay, because all of a sudden it's like, well, I've got a whole new interface, right? Like, I don't have to worry about this thing that will never get updated and that will be broken forever, because they're just not going to bother pushing an update to it. Instead, I can just use my phone that I always have with me. So
the biggest use for the last car we had, which it didn't have the ability to do CarPlay, was that it was really good for the suction cup that we used to mount our iPad onto the phone. You know, like, we would just suction cup it to it and put the iPad on and it would take over, you know, and call it a day. And when CarPlay came out, we were actually using the screen again, which was a new thing.
And you could downplay this and say, look, it's running a version of Android and it's going to have the Play Store and you're going to be able to do it. And that Verge story that Dan's referring to mentions that VW is working on something too, and they're very proud they're going to have their own app store. But like, when you start to think about that, I think it all unravels, because not only does it need to be on the Play Store in this case, so you have to have an Android version, number one. If you're an iPhone user, is the Android version from somebody who's not a great Android developer, Apple, for example? Are all the flags checked? Did the developer forget to check the flag for Android Automotive? Or are they not happy with it? They haven't checked it out. They don't know what the experience is going to be like. And again, what if you're using an app that doesn't have an Android version and you're an iPhone user? Or even if you are an Android user, you're talking about a separate device that has to sync all its data. Your phone has to sync its data with your cloud account, I guess, if you're using a podcast player or something like that. And of course, every time you do that, there's a chance for them to get out of sync. Whereas if it's on my phone and it's and then it's in a window on my car, I know it's my phone that I've preloaded. You're listening to music or podcasts and you're out of cellular range. Well, guess what? Your car doesn't have that connectivity. Your phone does. Your phone preloaded it and you've still got that stuff there to listen to. And again, yeah, I mean, there's Bluetooth, right? But I don't have a CarPlay car, actually. I haven't had a CarPlay car. My daughter has one. I installed a CarPlay head unit in her car aftermarket. But then she took it with her so selfishly to college. And so I don't have access to CarPlay anymore. And so I use Bluetooth everywhere I go. And I'll tell you, Bluetooth stinks. Bluetooth is great. Okay, it's great in the sense that you can get audio off of your phone. But like the interface is basically non-existent because it's this stack that was built so many years ago and is probably implemented inconsistently across all cars that basically you can just kind of go forward or backward and volume up and down. And forward and backward on a podcast player is like a 30-second forward. But like, what about a chapter skip? Or what about like, or what if I need to pick a different podcast to listen to in a playlist? Right now, that means I have to pick up my phone while I'm driving, which you don't want me to do, or I could tap a couple of things on a CarPlay interface. So like, even if you get past the app thing and say, oh, well, you can install apps on this thing, and even if you believe that your car maker is not going to have an app store that has lots of missing pieces, and even if you believe that your car maker suddenly doesn't get to the point where they're like, well, some apps we really don't want in our cars. And they start blacklisting apps, and you can't install them in their car because they don't want that app on there. They don't want Waze on there because they want them to use your navigation app. And, you know, this thing is the MLB app. You could theoretically watch video, and we don't want to allow that, and they're not going to do a custom version for our car. So we're just going to ban that one. And now that one's out of the store, even though it's in CarPlay or Android Auto. It's just, I have no trust, Dan said it, like, they're bad at this. This is not in their wheelhouse. I have no trust that this time is going to be different. It's going to be a Lucy pulls the football away from Charlie Brown kind of thing again, where they're going to talk a good game and they're going to roll this out and it's going to be limited and frustrating and not get updates and be from a company that doesn't understand technology. And I think we had this solved, which is, what if you give me a little window and let me project this phone that all my whole life is on, and I'll use that when I'm in the car. How about that? And I know that hurt them. That hurt their egos, right? And they're trying to take it back. And the only way this will stop is if people literally say, I'm not buying that car if it doesn't have CarPlay.
Yeah, is there a backlash here too? I just wondered a little bit. Last year at WWDC, Apple showed off its next generation of CarPlay, which is this whole idea that we'll work with vendors and you'll be able to sort of take over the entire instrumentation of your car and have it work the way you want. And is this a little bit of backlash from GM being like, whoa, that is too far. We don't want them taking over our carefully constructed odometer experience and saying like, we're going to make a deal so that we, you know, because Apple's trying to encroach on our ground essentially, and we don't even want to let them touch our stuff.
But it's a partner deal, right? So you would just not have it. Sure. They would just say, no, we're not doing that. We're just keeping it in a window.
They feel insulted though. It's maybe the weird thing. Well, I think there's a weird emotional aspect to it.
And they may be trying to signal back to other car makers like, hey, let's not go down this path. You know, we can't talk about it. That would be collusion, but we can say, we can make an announcement that we're getting rid of this completely. And that nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You probably don't want to keep on, you know, dealing with this, because by themselves they're in trouble. Like, I mean, I think they'll lose a lot of money, but if they all decide to drop it, then it puts them all in a better negotiating position.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of this is going to be in the details. Like, if they decide to make the entertainment center basically an Android device with parity with pretty much any other Android device you could buy, that wouldn't be quite so bad, because one of the things I like about the Google Play App Store versus the iOS store is that you can access it by apps through a website. And then when you buy the app, it'll say, here are all of the Android devices you have registered under your Google account. Here's a list of the ones that are compatible with this app. Choose which device you want to install this on. So it could be as simple as, for an iPhone user, go to play.google.com, buy Waze or buy whatever navigation or whatever kiddie music app that you want, and then select, hey, please put this on my car, and it just works. But the thing is, these people are just bastards, and so you can't. You can't count on them doing so. What if they they say, oh, it'll run Google apps, but what if they're saying that no, we're also going to have our own GM app store, and no, we're not going to let we're doing deals with the most popular navigation apps and the most popular entertainment apps, so that no, you can't just simply install this app or buy this for $9.99. You have to buy this as a $120 per month package of apps, and of course the usual burden that they're trying to put on everybody is that it offends them that they're not seeing a single penny from the second, third, fourth, fifth owner of this car. And by making as many things a service as possible, just simple navigation, they're not going to get the $18,000 it was sold onto as a secondhand car, but they can still stick the second owner for a feature that used to be free. I mean, this is basically the same reason why I continue to be offended that phones and other devices are deleting the headphone jack. You're taking away something that was useful to me that used to be free, and now making this into an $18 dongle. And it's not a problem that I don't have the $18. Again, I'm a freelance journalist, so that's always up for debate. But it's the question of why are you taking things away from me to try to turn me into a revenue stream? It's just offensive.
Well, and I do think that there's lots of ways we can see how GM might be able to get some advantage and make some more money and squeeze us a little harder. There's just nowhere to see how it's going to improve our experience of their cars. And that's an uphill battle. If you can't prove to us why that you're making it better for us, again, I think that they may find that I don't think they're going to about face. I think they're going to dig into this and go down that path. But I think it may be a seen later as a textbook, like, probably shouldn't have done that.
The reaction, I mean, it's interesting to say, it's an interesting are they testing the waters and trying to signal to their competitors that follow us to freedom, right? Or is it that Verge article is very interesting because it's basically saying lots of people don't like this, and I wonder if this is an interesting moment for all the other car makers who are looking at the reaction to this release and seeing
should
people say
too?
Let's push it, or say, oh, see, people do like their CarPlay. And, we have a competitive advantage in offering CarPlay, continuing to offer it when GM isn't. Or are they going to say, we'll just go down that path too, and then we can get Apple and Google, they'll either be our partner and do what we say, or they'll be out of our car entirely. But yeah, my trust in them, like Andy said, my trust in them is low for them to do a good job. And again, there is the fact, and it's just sheer corporate arrogance, right? It's the, if you work for a car company, the car is the most important thing in everybody's life, right? It's like, well, what do you mean? It's a GM car. It's like if you work at a record company and you think people really care that this record came out on Arista Records, and they don't. They don't care at all. They literally don't care. They only care about the artist. Well, GM, having their phone projected into your car makes your car better. You get to have Apple's glow and Apple's App Store and all the apps, if they're an iPhone user, rub off on your car. It's a benefit to you, but you lose control and you lose maybe a revenue opportunity where you can sell people on other services. I do wonder, when Andy talks about loading things from the web, I do wonder if they're like, well, your free connectivity is really only for our navigation. If you'd like other apps to have connectivity, of course, you have to buy our premium connectivity package, which is basically another cell phone bill except to GM. I don't know. This sounds like it's going to go badly. It's going to be bad.
Yeah, what it boils down to really is, if you really think your service is better, then you should compete with it on that ground. You should try to build a better thing and say, well, you can use CarPlay, but we've actually made this thing that's really good. But they're not going to do that. Again, they're just going to be like, no CarPlay.
I mean, there's very few things where people like bring up a car and they go, oh, I just bought this car. And you're always like, oh, that's great. What do you think of it and everything else? At this point, if anyone says, like, next year, I bought a GM, I bought a Chevy or I bought a Cadillac, I was like, oh, right, how's your iPhone working? Like it'll just be this kind of, like, stick that I, how's the iPhone working? It's really great, isn't it? And it'll just be this, like, pushback, because it's like, and people are going to feel bad about buying that car. And it's not going to just be the people who are really mad about it. It's going to be everyone around them. I know it's going to be everyone around me.
Yeah. See, I think that a lot of people in this, I think everybody in this conversation and a lot of people listening to this conversation will agree with you. I don't know if that will pervade into the civilian population, only because it'll be one of those things that, oh, well, that sucks, and then they'll get over it in a couple of weeks.
And the reality
what I'm saying is that I do think that these companies know they made that decision of, will this feature, if we make this change, will it affect how many cars we sell? And they decided that no, it really won't. If they got two cars that are absolutely neck and neck, ours and a competitor's, one connects to their phone better than the other, assuming that even comes to light during the testing, the test drive that they do, then we'll eat that. But we feel as though the revenue stream that we can acquire by taking over that center console, it more than outweighs whatever trivial amount of sales that we're going to lose because of it.
I think it's a gamble. I think it's a gamble because that stat was, I've looked it up, 79% of U.S. new car buyers said they would only consider purchasing a new car that has CarPlay. And that was not of Apple users. That's of all new car buyers. So probably the other 20% have an Android phone. But this is the thing. This is my question, and we don't have an answer for it. Is, do they mean it? Like, do they? How strongly do they really feel about it? Because the danger that GM faces is that CarPlay is a checkbox item now. And if you don't have it, people are like, oh, well, no, I care about CarPlay. What they're hoping to do is you get a test drive and you go in and you test drive the new Chevy Bolt that's got the amazing new GM, you know, infotainment system on it. And you really like the car. And at that point, you don't even think to ask if it has CarPlay. And you get it home and it doesn't have CarPlay. And you're like, yeah, I guess I'll use their apps and it won't matter. And we don't know how strong that 79% is. And GM is hoping that they're not that their option will blunt any loss of CarPlay. And I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah, the chances of that happening for an iPhone user will be very, very low, because you'll just be immediately, it doesn't matter how good the interface is. If it doesn't integrate with the rest of your life, you're not going to care. You know, like, you're not going to care that, like, I got all these other things that work really well with my phone. My car, the last car I had worked really well with my phone. This car doesn't work with my phone. Done. Like, you know, like it's, you know, and it's not going to matter how they could have an interface that is 10 times better than the iPhone. And most iPhone users would just go, it doesn't work with my iPhone, you know? And so I think that they're going to, you know, like, it's not CarPlay. I can have another car. And the reality is, I mean, the target market for Chevys or GM is a demographic that is not exactly high school or college students. like, I mean, the reality is there, I don't even know, maybe a big part of their audience even uses.
Well, when you talk about new car buyers, you're specifically talking about people who've got more money. So they're probably older because they're buying a new car and not a used car. And that's why you get that.
And
79%
GM moves that up again.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. GM. I don't think that's true, Alex. I think in the EV realm, which is what we're talking about here, the Chevy Bolt and Bolt EUV are actually considered pretty strong EVs. And so they've actually, you know, that's the perplexing thing here, is that they actually have a pretty good reputation as an EV manufacturer. But I want to mention, since we're talking about this in the context of Apple and CarPlay, I want to mention Tesla and Rivian, because those are two good examples of EV companies that have decided to build their own tech stack and not support CarPlay or Android Auto. And you might say, well, you know, Tesla and Rivian seem to be doing great in terms of this. It doesn't seem to have hurt them at all. And maybe that's the case. Maybe that's instructive. I will point you to, and I don't know if we want to call this up here, TeslaAndroid.com. I just want to point out that there's this gentleman in Poland, I love this, who has built on a Raspberry Pi foundation an Android install that goes in your Tesla that has a CarPlay receiver built into the Android install. Pretty amazing. And so you plug it in and you go to the Raspberry Pi via Wi-Fi on your Tesla web browser in your car. And what comes up in the web browser? CarPlay. Now, is this janky? I don't know. Maybe. Is this clever? It's super clever. I love that this guy did this, and it's all downloadable and you can try it out yourself. And there's some issues with it, right? Where you've got to, like, what the car has to be on the Wi-Fi of the Raspberry Pi so that they could talk to each other, or on a shared consensual Wi-Fi. And that's a challenge for various connectivity issues using Tesla's navigation system. My point here is not that TeslaAndroid.com is a mainstream application. My point is that despite all the EVs that Tesla is selling, I think Tesla sold the Model Y was the number one car sold in California last year. Like, all that success, there are still people out there hacking together ways to get CarPlay on their Tesla screen.
What's fascinating about that, too, is, and I think this is also something as these EVs get more and more popular, there's so much more integration. I don't know for a fact how true this is, but my sense is it is a lot harder to take a third-party head unit and put it in a modern EV, potentially, yeah, than it is in, like, your 10-year-old car, right? So are the third-party opportunities even lower, too, for the whole, like, hey, we're going to install, that's fine, I don't like my built-in system, I can just get a new unit and pop it in instead. And I don't know how feasible that is these days. And that's a little worrying if it's like, well, I'm stuck with whatever I have in here. I'm stuck with it forever.
It's so integrated that you can't take it out. That was even true of my minivan, right, which was from 2010, and it was so integrated that you could never remove it. My Nissan Leaf that I have from 2012, the screen is so integrated with all the controls and the charging timers and things like that. It's like, good luck. You basically can't take it out. And the more advanced these EVs get, the more that's true. So you can't just swap out the double DIN head unit a CarPlay
model. You don't have the CD player. You don't have the CD player anymore. You know, my wife's car has the CarPlay and everything else, and it's great. I have one that is older, and the best part of the CD player is you can insert a thing into the CD player that holds a holder that you can put your iPad on. So the thing is that those are all, you know, the CD players turned out to be a great little ledge that you can stick things into to make that actually work. But I think that, again, I think that the problem really is that, like, I would never consider a car. And again, I even looked at Teslas, and I thought I'd buy a Tesla, and instead I bought more cameras. But but you know, I did.
It was the most Alex Lindsay statement ever.
I was like, oh, maybe I'll get a Tesla. I was like,
well, Alex's cameras cost what cars cost, though. So that does actually so make sense. Like, that makes a lot of sense.
Worst luck in the world is to, like, get in a fender bender with Alex, because, oh my God, will that be documented? And then when he gets the data and puts it together, say, judge, jury, please put on your AR goggles.
Are my cameras okay? Did my camera survive the fender bender? I don't know. We won't know for a while. This is a future direction for GM involving this whole thing. We'll see if they have additional comments. This is really kind of an ongoing story. I love that The Verge followed up with people like me being cranky and have said that a lot of people are negative about this. And I do think this is a precipitous moment for the auto industry, where they could absolutely say, you know, we user experience be damned. We've decided to take back power and control over our users, or whether they're too concerned that now that we've all gotten a taste of freedom of bringing our own technology and software into our cars and having it be properly integrated, that we will never go back to the way it was before.
I can't wait to hear, like, a GM presentation where someone announced this, say, one word, coverage.
Well, and I think that the only thing I'll say is that I think that they are worried about the fact that Apple and Google are both doing a lot of R&D around cars themselves. And while they can say you can never compete with us with cars, they said that about phones, they said that about watches, they said that about a lot of other things that Apple dips its toe into. And it may, you know, if Apple, you know, comes all the way out, what feature set do they have that anyone cares about? No one's, you know, like, I just don't think the future, talking to my kids and talking to other folks that are younger than me and looking at my own use case, I just don't care. I don't want to drive anymore. Like, it's annoying, you know, and it's, you know, I just want to sit in the back and have it take me to the place I need to go, and then I'll get
best
out.
Best feature is public transit, everybody.
Yes.
There you go.
And it worked in the United States. I agree with you. In Europe and many other places, I don't even think about getting a car. Like, I don't, you know, like, it's like, it works. It's just the problem with the United States doesn't.
Yeah. I won't take this down into a full rat hole, but it's always fascinating to me that so many companies putting so many billions of dollars into self-driving technology that will probably make it to level 3, might make it to level 4, level 5 is of science fiction at this point, but nobody's willing to invest in, how about if we work on the infrastructure to make the roads work better? What if we put a fraction of that money into public transportation to make sure that when people need to get from A to B, they can do so without putting one person per car? All this sort of stuff. And it's like, there's simpler solutions to this problem, but none of the other ones involve, like, firing lots and lots of people. You can always always get lots of funding and technology to investigate a technology that will allow an industry to fire tens, if not hundreds or millions of people.
Self-driving buses. Clearly the answer. All right. It is going to be time for the picks of the week. And guess what? I am going to use the host discretion and not have a pick, but my three guests will have their picks. And that is coming up shortly after this word again from a time traveling Leo Laporte. Leo?
If I may, I'd like to interrupt this lovely episode of Mac Break Weekly. Thank you for filling in for me, by the way. With the name of our studio sponsor, you've seen it all around, ACI Learning. But you've also probably heard the name IT Pro. For the last decade, our partners at IT Pro have brought you entertaining, engaging IT training to level up your career or your organization. Well, now IT Pro is part of ACI Learning. Yeah, and that's a good thing. With IT Pro, ACI Learning can expand its reach, its production capabilities, and offer you the learning content you need at any stage in your development, any way you like it, remote, hybrid, or even in person. If you're getting into IT, you probably have heard that one of the most widely recognized beginner certs is the CompTIA A+ certification. CompTIA courses with IT Pro from ACI Learning make it easy to go from daydreaming about that career in IT to actually getting it off the ground. Earning certificates is important not only because if it's your first job in IT, you got to show them you got the knowledge, but it also shows them you've got the determination, the ambition, the persistence to learn the skills and to take the test and to get the cert. And that's important to employers. It also helps you, if you're already in the field, get promotions to get additional certs, right? Tech is one industry where opportunities are outpacing growth, especially in the cybersecurity field. The demand for talent is unlimited, basically. Tech continues to be a field that requires a lot of expertise and, as a result, commands higher pay, right? You get paid more. Right now, about a third of information security jobs require a cybersecurity certification. 23% of all IT jobs require a cybersecurity certification. Organizations are hungry for cybersecurity talent. There's a big gap. You can help fill that gap. And by the way, get a great paying job. The average salary for cybersecurity specialists, $116,000 a year. ACI Learning's information security analyst and cybersecurity specialist programs, two great tracks that can help you get certified and get that great job. ACI Learning offers multiple cybersecurity training programs to prepare you to enter or advance within this field. CISSP, Certified Ethical Hacker, Certified Network Defender, Cybersecurity Audit School, Cybersecurity Frameworks. Those are some of the most popular, but there's lots more. And the thing is, it's exciting, it's great, it's fascinating, and it's preparing you for a great job or an even better job. Now, I know for many people, learning remotely on-demand courses is their preferred way to do it. For some people, you might want to be in person with an instructor and other students. Well, the great thing about ACI Learning is they've got both. You can learn on-demand, remotely, or in person. Take your learning beyond the classroom with ACI Learning. ACI Learning includes IT Pro, but there's also now Audit Pro, Practice Labs, those great learning hubs for in-person learning, and their partnership program. If you've got a business with a team, from 2 to 1,000, volume discounts start at 5 seats. Ask about a free 2-week trial of training for your team. Your team will love it. The boss will love it. You will love it because you'll get some really great upskilled workers. ACI Learning, transforming how companies train and technology professionals learn to fuel the modern workforce. For premium training in audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, visit go.acilearning.com/twit. That's go. .acilearning.com/twit. Don't forget the offer code TWIT30. That gives you 30% off a standard or premium individual IT Pro membership. We thank them so much for their support. We welcome ACI Learning to our studios and invite you to check them out, but make sure you use that address so they know you saw it here. go.acilearning.com/twit. And don't forget, 30% off with the offer code TWIT30. Now, back to the show.
All right, my pick of the week is these three guys giving their picks, because I can do that because I'm the host. Why don't we start with our guest, Dan Morin. Do you have a special Dan Morin MacBreak Weekly pick for us?
Yes, very, very special. I have, I do more and more of these shows now that I feel like are on video. And of course, we all know the key to good video is good lighting. I don't know how good my lighting is, but I will say my room lighting as it was, not very good. So I picked up the Logitech Litra Glow for $60, which is a little light that sits on top of your monitor. If you happen to have one, I've got an Apple Studio display here, and it plugs in via USB. And you can turn it on. It does a bunch of different color temperatures, a bunch of different brightnesses, and it's really convenient. I like it a lot. My one quibble with it is that Logitech software, which you can use to control it via your computer, is kind of garbagey. There are some workarounds. I wrote about one over on Six Colors about how you can sort of set up shortcuts to do some of the control there, which is nice. But I do wish Logitech would open that up and have an API available. But what I would say is, you know, it's cheap. Which is not a small thing if you're looking to set up like a little video setup on the without spending too much money. And it's pretty well designed for all things. It's got a nice little tilt and adjustment, and it sits pretty well on top of my monitor. So I give that a thumbs up. I'm sure I could do better for lighting, but for $60, it's hard to argue the case.
We can see you. So that's good.
I'm visible and lit.
And a lot of us have lots of Zoom meetings and things. So being in a, you know, most people, not us, but most people don't work in a place where they set it up and they go, okay, how's my lighting? Like for like a video. And then you get on a video call and it looks like you're in a horror movie and you think something has to change. So lighting is important for all of us now. Alex, what do you have for us?
Yeah, yesterday on Office Hours, we had Descript come on, and they kind of walked us through it, and wow,
yeah.
It just blew my mind. Like, my mind just kind of wrapped open, you know, and you know, people in Office Hours had been using Descript and talking about it, and I had someone working on the podcast that I do with Michael Krasny, the graymatter.show. We do, we were using it for some of the post stuff, not some of the production, in it, because I was all like, I'm just going to bring this into Logic. I don't need Descript, and you can use that for the little cutouts and so on and so forth. But watching watching Descript show what it was, I just kind of, it kind of popped my mind open. So basically, you can take your podcast, you get your records, you can have multi-track, you can put them all in there. It'll identify all the words for you. You can go through and just edit. I want to take this out. Oh, I want to get rid of all the ums, which I still say too many of. I want to get rid of the silences that are longer than half a second. I want to get rid, you know, I want to do this stuff. And you can do all those edits, and it's doing it all. You're doing it all to the text. And then it just pulls it all together, you know, and it will, if you, oh, do you want lower, you do you want some, do you want captions? Or do you want the captions to be full screen? Do you want them just to automatically be generated and go along with them? Do you want, all those things are just kind of built into the thing. And what we really started uncovering talking to them is, you can turn it into a full production. You can be adding B-roll and you can add, you know, all these other video clips. And when you do that, like in Final Cut, like the magnetic timeline, you still cut things out, and it just pulls everything along with it to keep it, to allow you to assemble this. And from an assembly perspective, I think that we're about, after seeing what I saw yesterday on Office Hours, I think that we're going to start our podcast by putting into Descript. You know, cut it all down and then export it. There's still some filtering and other things that I want to do in Logic, and I'll still do all of those things. But as far as getting it to where we want it, it's so much faster to do it in Descript than it would be, than it was ever. You know, every time someone has a bunch of edits, like we have an edit on a podcast, and it's like, oh, take this little part out, and I shouldn't have said this. And then that doesn't even count the fact that, like, if someone says a word, a lot of times what happens is they got garbled somehow, or they didn't say the right name and you want to change that name. You can take this and just type in, like, you didn't say center, you said, you know, or something. And you can just have that person's voice say that word.
Yep.
I don't know if I do the whole podcast that way, but it will rebuild it to put that voice back in, and to be able to pull all those pieces back together is unbelievable.
It's miraculous. I used it for a podcast project back in 2020. Where I was doing a lot of different interviews and then trying to intersperse them together. And the idea that you could, basically, it's like you edit a podcast like you're just editing a Word doc or a Google doc. And yeah, that part is remarkable. And then you made an important point, because I've talked to people who've been really skeptical about this. I was really skeptical about this for a long time. But for certain projects, if you're just doing cleanup of, like, you know, put in the theme song, then don't worry about it. But if you're doing substantive content edits to a podcast, to be able to see the words and move them around or pull them out or do whatever, offer is amazing. And then if you are very exacting in terms of production, you know what? I exported all of those, that series that I did in 2020, to Logic. And then I put them in Logic where I had control over the compressor and the output. Exactly. And I could do little tiny, again, it's not, Descript has done an amazing job building a nonlinear audio editor in what is essentially web technology. But there's stuff you could do in Logic or Audition or something to just fine tune everything at the end. That's fine. Like, but this huge amount of work at the beginning, you could just do it in Descript and not worry about it. It's really like magic. It is magical.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's a lot of things. Like, one of the things we do is we do all of our, a lot of our podcasts over Zoom. And the problem you get into is at a certain distance, there is this long gap, and long gaps don't make people feel smarter. You know, like they, you know, like it feels like there's this long gap. You ask them a question and then there's this long gap. And the idea of being able to tell Descript, just shorten all those gaps.
Yep.
Like anything that they took too long on, you know, just shorten those all up, really tightens the whole show up. It might only make it a minute or 2 minutes shorter than it was overall, but it makes it feel much snappier, you know, and gives it a lot more energy. People have been trying to persuade, I can be very slow about things, and people can sit there. They've been trying to persuade me to use it for like a year, you know, and I was just like, oh, I have Logic. I can just do this thing. And now I'm like, as soon as I went through that hour, I was like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah. There's that control freaky nature, right? Which is like, I know how to do this. I'll edit it myself. And then I need to intersperse 15 different interviews sentence by sentence with different voices. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? And then I thought, well, I'll make transcripts and then I'll edit the transcripts and then I'll hand it to an editor and say, here's the edits with the time code, go edit this in Logic for me. And then I thought, or I could literally just use Descript where I copy and paste different sentences and the audio goes along with, and it's amazing. So, amazing.
And the idea that, like, a lot of times you have to cut something and the way that they said it, they slurred into that next word. And now you can just take that word out, put another one.
They've got voice generation tech that they can do. It's also good for, my understanding is, like, if you're doing a documentary or an NPR something where the host is not available and you need a word, right? Like, you can just generate the word. And you could use that for evil, but that's not what it's for. It's being used for good. It's great. Thank you. That's descript.com. And you can try it out for free, and then you pay. But you try it out for free, and you'll be amazed. You will be amazed. Andy, what do you have for us?
Our conversation about losing CarPlay and Android Auto made me think of one of my evergreen recommendations. Car mounts for phones and tablets, they get a really bad rap because most of them are absolutely terrible. They're like suction cups that don't hold, or it just jams into your like a car vent, or in a really, really weird way. And either way, like, unless you're on a pool table smooth road, like, there's vibration that makes it hard to, like, actually take a look at the screen and get really quick information. But forget about that. There's a company called RAM mounts that makes an entire industry out of just mounting technology inside cars and planes and boats. And they are the real deal for sure. All the components are really like heavy cast metal. When you lock a screen in place, it absolutely stays there. It's a modular system. So, I have a hard mount. It was worth putting a couple screws in my dashboard to have like the mounting post for my phone right there in the dashboard, exactly where I want it to be. But when I travel and I know that I'm going to be renting a car, I can take everything off of that post except for leaving the post behind, snap that onto a really industrial suction cup or some other sort of a mount, and now I can use that in the rental car just as easily. And it's all modular, so if you're worried about, like, gee, the arm isn't long enough, or I can't put this into landscape mode, or hey, I just switched from to a larger phone, or now I've been using the phone for a long time and now I actually want to buy an iPad mini specifically for the car, you don't have to buy everything all over again. You just buy the thing that makes the arm longer, or you just buy the thing that holds up your phone or your tablet. Even their systems for, like, kind of soft mounting your phone and your tablet, if you're not going to leave it there permanently, if you just really want to dock it when you come in, take it off when you leave, the systems they have are so easy to click this into place, and then so easy to remove it. And they're not expensive at all. Like, if a really bad, like Amazon.com bargain costs $22 and doesn't really work, you could put together a system that's specific to your needs for about $35 to $40. And once again, I've got, at this point, I've got a, every time that I need something to do something new over the past 10 or 15 years, I've bought like another accessory or another component to make that, that solution. And now I have this box of RAM mount components. And every time that I'm in a new situation, like when I was testing a whole bunch of different like bike software, bike phone apps. So I have like, I need to have like three phones mounted on the handlebars of my bike. Plus I want a camera mounted on another place. It was just simply take all this stuff that I bought with no intention of ever putting it on a bike. And all I had to do was like buy like a $12 component to put this on the handlebars. Highest recommendation. And if I, it's the reason why I don't particularly care what the in-dash entertainment system is, because I really much prefer having my iPad mini or my phone up there on the dash. Again, not, I don't get the idea of driving like this then having to go like that every time you need to see what the turn is. I always have my phone set up so that it's at the exact, it's always to my left at the exact same height as my rearview mirror on the outside, so that as I'm scanning the mirrors while I'm driving, my eyes will also naturally track across that phone screen, so I can see, okay, I don't have to worry about a turn in front of the 5.2 miles or whatever like that. So definitely take a look at it. It is the real deal. You've had your heart broken by this stuff before. This will mend it for you very, very easily. Again, if there's any reason, if you have, you'll not doubt the value of drilling holes in your dash to permanently mount some of this stuff inside your car, because you'll know that, great, I'm going to be, if I have this car for another 8 years, I'm going to be using the stuff for 8 years.
RamMount.com. Thank you, Andy. That brings us to the end of Backbreak Weekly. Only time left to thank my guest, Dan Morin. Thanks for replacing me, who's replacing Leo this week. I appreciate it. Hey, you have a site where you write about technology and stuff?
Oh, yeah, I do have one of those sites. It's called, tip of my tongue, Six Colors. You can find more over
sounds
at sixcolors.com. It's got all six colors, entire rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
It's nice. And also, you write books. What's your latest book?
I do write books. My latest book is The Nova Incident, which came out last July. I've written a whole bunch of books in the Galactic Cold War series. You can find out more about those at dmorin.com, and they're available in fine bookstores everywhere. I always recommend you check out your local independent bookstore because they're great.
Some of them are available in terrible bookstores, but they're all available.
I don't
in fine
go. Don't
bookstores.
Go to those.
Isn't there fine?
Go to the fine bookstores.
The fine bookstores are the best. Fine Corinthian bookstores. It's excellent. Andy and I go. If I would be remiss if I didn't ask when you are going to be on the airwaves at WGBH Boston, which of course I remember fondly from watching Zoom when I was a kid. On PBS, the radio side. I've seen you live. By the way, I love when you talk to Leo about being at the Boston Public Library, where I have seen you perform live as a tech expert on WGBH.
Accent on the word perform. Thank you very much. I'm off this week, but I'm actually at the BPL on next Thursday at 12:30. You can be there live, buy yourself a cup of coffee and a cookie.
Eat a sandwich.
From the sandwiches, eat a sandwich. It's quite lovely. Mm-hmm. Last week we had a full house, which was like, and there were like active, like applauding things. So it was like, oh, they like that. Oh, and then you're like, gee, they didn't have a reaction to that line that I said, gee, maybe I should change my, it gets in your head, but it's a lot of fun. If you don't want to be there at the BPL, check out, go to WGBHnews.org. You can stream the audio live or later. The ones that are on video, like when we do stream from the studios at the BPL, they're on YouTube. So you can go to WGBH News channel on YouTube and watch that later.
Very nice. Very nice. And Alex Lindsay, last but not least, officehours.global090. Media, what do you have going on?
Well, I would highly recommend checking out the descript
yeah,
that we did yesterday. It is probably like, the reason I would say that is I didn't get it until I really watched that hour. And the real advantage of our second hours is that it's not based on one person. If I had interviewed them by myself, I probably wouldn't have gotten the same value. It's the fact that there's so many people asking questions about it all, you know, at the same time. You get this power of the hive mind asking questions from a lot of different directions. People that are using it, people aren't using it, people are looking at it from different angles. So I would definitely check that out. And, you know, a lot of our second hours are a lot of fun. We're getting ready for NAB It's 2 weeks away from now, and we've got 50 people descending on NAB, about 15 to 20 on site and about another 25 to 30 off site. And so it should be a really busy, busy week.
All right. Awesome. And we will all be back next week, of course, except for Dan, who is just a guest. But I will be back in that square where Dan is now. And I believe Mike Sargent will be sitting in this chair or an alternate chair, depending on how he feels about sitting in Leo's chair. But regardless, thank you all for being here and being kind to your guest host for filling in for Leo. But I have to be a little cranky here and say, hey, you, get back to work, you. Break time is over.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow is a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.